Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. Tonight's stories are a tribute to baseball, America's favorite pastime. Spring training has begun, and folks are talking baseball. Our first story is The Rube by Zane Grey. Yes, the same Zane Grey that wrote all the westerns. It's a fun and frolicking story of minor league ball. Our second story is the short story that inspired a novel that became a movie classic, Shoeless Joe Jackson Comes to Iowa by W.P. Kinsella. So, without further delay, let's play ball!
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team if they don't win.
The Rube by Zane Grey from The Red-Headed Outfield and Other Baseball Stories. It was the most critical time I had yet experienced in my career as a baseball manager, and there was more than the usual reason why I must pull the team out. A chance for a business deal depended upon the goodwill of the stockholders of the Worcester Club. On the outskirts of the town was a little cottage that I wanted to buy, and this depended upon the business deal. My whole future happiness depended upon the little girl I hoped to install in that cottage. Coming to the Worcester Eastern League team, I had found a strong aggregation and an enthusiastic following. I really had a team with pennant possibilities. Providence was a strong rival, but I beat them 3 straight in the opening series, set a fast pace, and likewise set Worcester baseball mad. The Eastern League clubs were pretty evenly matched. Still, I continued to hold the lead until misfortune overtook me. Greg smashed an umpire and had to be laid off. Mullaney got spiked while sliding and was out of the game. Ashwell sprained his ankle and Hirsch broke a finger. Radborn, my great pitcher, hurt his arm on a cold day and he could not get up his old speed. Stringer, who had batted 371 and led the league the year before, struck a bad spell and could not hit a barn door handed up to him. Then came the slump. The team suddenly let down, went to pieces, played ball that would have disgraced an amateur nine. It was a trying time. Here was a great team, strong everywhere. A little hard luck had dug up a slump, and now, day by day, the team dropped in the race. When we reached the second division, the newspaper flayed us. Worcester would never stand for a second division team. Baseball admirers, reporters, fans, especially the fans, are fickle. The admirers quit, the reporters grilled us, and the fans, though they stuck to the games with that barnacle-like tenacity peculiar to them, made life miserable for all of us. I saw the pennant slowly fading, and the successful season, and the business deal, and the cottage, and Millie. When I thought of her, I just could not see failure. Something must be done. But what? I was at the end of my wits. When Jersey City beat us that Saturday, 11-2, shoving us down to 5th place with only a few percentage points above the Fall River team, I grew desperate. And locking my players in the dressing room, I went after them. They had laid down on me and needed a jar. I told them so straight and flat, and being bitter, I did not pick and choose my words. "And fellas," I concluded, "you've got to brace. A little more of this and we can't pull out. I tell you, you're a championship team. We had that pennant cinched. A few cuts and sprains and hard luck, and you all quit. You laid down. I've been patient. I've plugged for you. Never a man have I fined or thrown down, but now I'm at the end of my string. I'm out to fine you now, and I'll release the first man who shows the least yellow. I play no more substitutes. Crippled or not, you guys have got to get in the game." I waited to catch my breath and expected some outburst, as managers usually get from criticized players, but not a word. Then I addressed some of them personally. Greg, your layoff ends today. You play Monday. Mulaney, you've drawn your salary for 2 weeks with that spiked foot. If you can't run on it, well, all right. But I put it up to your good faith. I've played the game, and I know it's hard to run on a sore foot. But you can do it. Ashwell, your ankle is lame, I know. Now, can you run? Sure I can. I'm not a quitter. I'm ready to go in, replied Ashwell. Ratty, how about you, I said, turning to my star twirler. Connolly, I've seen as fast a team in as bad a rut and yet pull out, returned Radburn. We're about due for the brace. When it comes, look out. As for me, well, my arm isn't right. But it's acting these warm days in a way that tells me it will be soon. It's been worked too hard. Can't you get another pitcher? I'm not knocking Hearn or Cairns. They're good for their turn, but we need a new man to help out. And he must be a crackerjack if we're going to get back to the lead. Where on earth can I find such a pitcher? I shouted, almost distracted. Well, that's up to you, replied Radburn. Up to me, it certainly was, and I cudgeled my brains for inspiration. After I had given up in hopelessness, it came in the shape of a notice I read in the newspapers. It was a brief mention of an amateur Worcester ball team being shut out in a game with the Ricketsville Nine. Ricketsville played Sunday ball, which gave me an opportunity to look them over. It took some train riding and then a journey by coach to get to Ricketsville. I mingled with the crowd of talking rustics. There was only one little bleachers, and this was loaded to the danger point with the feminine adherents of the game. Most of the crowd centered alongside and back of the catcher's box. I edged in and got a position just behind the stone that served as home plate. Hunting up a player in this way was no new thing to me. I was too wise to make myself known before I had sized up the merits of my man. So before the players came upon the field, I amused myself watching the rustic fans and listening to them. Then a roar announced the appearance of the Ricketsville team and their opponents, who wore the name of Spatsburg on their Canton flannel shirts. The uniforms of these country amateurs would have put a Philadelphia Mummers parade to the blush, at least for bright colors. But after one amused glance, I got down to the stern business of the day, and that was to discover a pitcher, and failing that, baseball talent of any kind. Never shall I forget my first glimpse of the Ricketsville twirler. He was far from over 6 feet tall and as lean as a fence rail. He had a great shock of light hair, a sunburned, sharp-featured face, wide, sloping shoulders, and arms enormously long. He was about as graceful and had about as much of a baseball walk as a crippled cow. "He's a rube," I ejaculated in disgust and disappointment. But when I seen him throw one ball to his catcher, I grew as keen as a fox on a scent. What a speed he had! I got round closer to him and watched him with sharp, eager eyes. He was a giant. To be sure, he was lean, raw-boned as a horse, but powerful. What won me at once was his natural, easy swing. He got the ball away with scarcely any effort. I wondered what he could do when he brought that motion of his body into play. "Hey, bub, what might be the pitcher's name?" I asked of a boy. "Mister, his name might be Dennis, but it ain't," replied this country youngster. Evidently, my question had thrown some implication upon this particular player. "I reckon you be stranger in these parts," said a pleasant old fella. "His name's Hurdle, Whitaker Hurdle, Wit for short. He hain't lost a goal durn game this summer, no siree. Never pitched before another." Hurdle, what a remarkably fitting name. Ricketts chose the field, and the game began. Hurdle swung with his easy motion. The ball shot across like a white bullet. It was a strike, and so was the next, and the one succeeding. He could not throw anything but strikes, and it seemed the Spatsburg players could not make even a foul. Outside of Hurdle's work, the game meant little to me, and I was so fascinated by what I saw in him that I could hardly contain myself. After the first few innings, I no longer tried to. I yelled with the Ricketsville Rooters. The man was a wonder. A blind baseball manager could have seen that. He had a straight ball, shoulder high, level as a stretch string, and fast. He had a jump ball, which he evidently worked by putting on a little more steam, and it was the speediest thing I have ever seen in the way of a shoot. He had a wide, sweeping out curve, wide as the blade of a mowing scythe. And he had a drop, an unhittable drop. He did not use it often, for it made his catcher dig too hard into the dirt. But whenever he did, I glowed all over. Once or twice, he used an underhand motion and sent in a ball that fairly swooped up. It could not have been hit with a board. And best of all, dearest to the manager's heart, he had control. Every ball he threw went over the plate. He could not miss it. To him, that plate was as big as a house. What a find! Already, I had visions of the long-looked-for brace of my team, and of the pennant, and the little cottage, and the happy light of a pair of blue eyes. What he meant to me, that country pitcher Hurdle! He shut out the Spatsburg team without a run or a hit or even a scratch. Then I went after him. I collared him and his manager, and there, surrounded by the gaping players, I bought him and signed him before any of them knew what exactly I was all about. I did not haggle. I asked the manager what he wanted and produced the cash. I asked Hurdle what he wanted, doubled his ridiculously modest demand, paid him in advance, and got his name to the contract. Then I breathed a long, deep breath, the first one for weeks. Something told me that with Hurdle's signature in my pocket, I had the Eastern League pennant. Then I invited all concerned down to the Ricketsville Hotel. We made connections at the railroad junction and reached Worcester at midnight, in time for a good sleep. I took the silent and backward pitcher to my hotel. In the morning, we had breakfast together. I showed him about Worcester and then carried him off to the ball grounds. I had ordered morning practice, and as morning practice is not conducive to the cheerfulness of the ball players, I wanted to reach the dressing room a little late. When we arrived, all the players had dressed and were out on the field. I had some difficulty in fitting Hurdle with a uniform, and when I did get him dressed, he resembled a two-legged giraffe decked out in white shirt, gray trousers, and maroon stockings. Spears, my veteran first baseman and captain of the team, was the first to see us. "Suffering umpires!" yelled Spears. "Here, you Mix, look at this con's got with him!" What a yell burst from that sore and disgruntled bunch of ball tossers. My players were a grouchy set in practice anyway, and today they were in their meanest mood. "Hey, Beanpole! Get on the stilts! Con, where'd you find that?" I cut short their chafing with a sharp order for batting practice. "Regular lineup, now no monkey biz," I went on. "Take two cracks and a bunt. Here, Hurdle," I said, drawing him toward the pitcher's box. "Don't pay any attention to their talk. That's only the fun of ball players. Go in now and practice a little. Lam a few over." Hurdle's big, freckled hands closed nervously over the ball. I thought it was best not to say more to him, for he had a rather wild look. I remembered my own stage fright upon my first appearance in fast company. Besides, I knew what my amiable players would say to him. I had a secret hope and belief that presently they would yell upon the other side of the fence. McCall, my speedy little left fielder, led off at bat. He was full of ginger, chipper as a squirrel, sarcastic as only a tried ball player can be. "Put 'em over, Slats! Put 'em over!" he called, viciously swinging his ash. Hurdle stood stiff and awkward in the box and seemed to be rolling something in his mouth. Then he moved his arm. We all saw the ball dart down straight. That is, all of us except McCall, because if he had seen it, he might have jumped out of the way. Crack! The ball hit him on the shin. McCall shrieked. We all groaned. Oh, that crack hurt all of us. Any ball player knows how it hurts to be hit on the shin bone. McCall waved his bat madly. Rube! 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 He yelled. Then and there, Hurdle got the name that was to cling to him all his baseball days. McCall went back to the plate, red in the face, mad as a hornet, and he sidestepped every time Rube pitched a ball. He never even ticked one and retired in disgust, limping and swearing. Ashwell was next. He did not show much alacrity. On Rube's first pitch, down went Ashwell flat in the dust. The ball whipped the air of his head. Rube was wild, and I began to get worried. Ashwell hit a couple of measly punks, but when he assayed a bunt, the gang yelled derisively at him. What's he got? The old familiar cry of batters when facing a new pitcher. Stringer went up, bold and formidable. That was what made him the great hitter he was. He loved to bat. He would have faced anybody. He would have faced even a cannon. New curves were a fascination to him, and speed for him, in his own words, was apple pie. In this instance, surprise was in store for Stringer. Rube shot up the straight one, then the wide curve, then the drop. String missed them all, struck out, fell down ignominiously. It was the first time he had fanned that season, and he looked dazed. We had to haul him away. I called off the practice, somewhat worried about Rube's showing, and undecided whether or not to try him in the game that day. So I went to Radbourne, who had quietly watched Rube while on the field. Raddy was an old pitcher, and had seen the rise of 100 stars. I told him about the game at Ricketsville and what I thought of Rube, and frankly asked his opinion. Well, Con, you've made the find of your life, said Raddy, quietly and deliberately. This from Radbourne was not only comforting, it was relief, hope, assurance. I avoided Spears, for it would hardly be possible for him to regard the Rube favorably, and I kept under cover until time to show up at the grounds. Buffalo was on the ticket for that afternoon, and the Bisons were leading the race and playing in top-notch form. I went into the dressing room while the players were changing suits, because there was a little unpleasantness that I wanted to spring on them before we got on the field. Boys, I said curtly, Hurdle works today. Cut loose now and back him up. I had to grab a bat and pound on the wall to stop the uproar. Did you much hear what I said? Well, it goes. Not a word now. I'm handling this team. We're in bad, I know, but it's my judgment to pitch Hurdle, Rube or no Rube, and it's up to you to back us. That's the baseball of it. Grumbling and muttering, they passed out of the dressing room. I knew ball players. If Hurdle should happen to show good form, they would turn in a flash. Rube tagged reluctantly in their rear. He looked like a man in a trance. I wanted to speak encouragingly to him, but Raddy told me to keep quiet. It was inspiring to see my team practice that afternoon. There had come a subtle change. I foresaw one of those baseball climaxes that can be felt and seen but not explained. Whether it was a hint of the hoped-for brace or only another flash of form before the final letdown, I had no means to tell, but I was on edge. Carter, the umpire, called out the batteries, and I sent my team into the field. When that long, lanky, awkward rustic started for the pitcher's box, I thought the bleachers would make him drop in his tracks. The fans were sore on any one of those days, and a new pitcher was bound to hear from them. Where, oh, where, oh, where? Connolly's found another dead one. Scarecrow. Look at his pants. Pat his legs. Then the inning began and things happened. Rube had marvelous speed, but he could not find the plate. He threw the ball the second he got it. He hit men, walked men, and fell over himself trying to field bunts. The crowd stormed and railed and hissed. The Bisons pranced around the bases and yelled like Indians. Finally, they retired with 8 runs. 8 runs! Enough to win 2 games. I could not have told how it happened. I was sick and all but crushed. Still, I had a blind, dogged faith in the big rustic. I believe he had not got started right. It was a trying situation. I called Spears and Ratty to my side and talked fast. "It's all off now. Let the dinged rube take his medicine," growled Spears. "Don't take him out," said Ratty. "He's not shown at all what's in him. The blamed hayseed is up in the air. He's crazy. He doesn't know what he's doing. I tell you, Con, he may be scared to death, but he's dead in earnest." Suddenly, I recalled the advice of the pleasant old fellow at Ricketts. "Spears, you're the captain," I said sharply. "Go after the rube. Wake him up. Tell him he can't pitch. Call him a pogey. That's a name that stirs him up."
"Well, I'll be dinged. He looks it," replied Spears. "Here, Rube, get off the bench. Come here."
Rube lurched towards us. He seemed to be walking in his sleep. His breast was laboring, and he was dripping with sweat.
"Whoever told you you could pitch?"
asked Spears genially. He was master at baseball ridicule. I had never yet seen the youngster who could stand his badinage. He said a few things and wound up with, "Come now, you cross between a hay rack and a wagon tongue. Get sore and do something. Pitch if you can. Show us. Do you hear, you toe-headed pogey?" Rube jumped as if he'd been struck. His face flamed red and his eyes turned black. He shoved his big fist under Captain Spears's nose.
"Mister, I'll lick you for that after the game. I'll show you doggone well how I can pitch."
"Good," exclaimed Ratty, and I echoed his word. Then I went to the bench and turned my attention to the game. Someone told me that McCall had made a couple of fouls, and after waiting for 2 strikes and 3 balls, had struck out. Ashwell had beat a bunt in his old swift style, and Stringer was walking up to the plate on the moment. It was interesting, even in a losing game, to see Stringer go to bat. We all watched him, as we had all been watching him for weeks, expecting him to break his slump with one of the 2 drives that made him famous. Stringer stood to the left side of the plate, and I could see the bulge of his closely locked jaw. He swung on the first pitched ball. With a solid rap, we all rose to watch that hit. The ball lined first and soared, and did not begin to drop till it was far beyond the right field fence. For an instant, we were all still. So were the bleachers. Stringer had broke his slump with the longest drive ever made on the grounds. The crowd cheered as he trotted around the bases behind Ashwell. 2 runs.
"Con, how'd you like that drive?"
he asked me, with a bright gleam in his eyes.
"Oh, a beaut," I replied incoherently.
The players on the bench were all as glad as I was. Henry flew out to left. Mullaney smashed a 2-bagger to right. Then Greg hit safely, but Mullaney, in trying to score on the play, was out at the plate. 4 hits. "I tell you, fellas, something's coming off," said Ratty. "Now, if only the rube." What a difference there was in that long rustic. He stalked into the box, unmindful of the hooting crowd, and grimly faced Schultz, the first batter up for the Bisons. This time, Rube was deliberate. And where he had not swung before, he now got his body and arm into full motion. The ball came in like a glint of light. Schultz looked surprised. The umpire called strike.
"Wow," yelled the Buffalo coacher.
Rube sped up the side wheeler, and Schultz reached wide to meet it and failed. The third was the lightning drop straight over the plate. The batter poked weakly at it. Then Carl struck out, and Manning, following, did likewise. 3 of the best hitters in the Eastern retired on 9 strikes. That was no fluke.
I knew what it meant, and I sat there hugging myself with the hum of something joyous in my ears. Greg had a glow on his sweaty face. Oh, but, boys, take a tip from me. The Rube's a world beater. Ratty knew it. He sized up that swing, and now I know it. Get wise, you its! When old Spears pasted a single through shortstop, the Buffalo manager took Clary out of the box and put in Vane, their best pitcher. Bogart advanced the runner to second, but was thrown out on the play. Then Rube came up. He swung a huge bat and loomed over the Bison's twirler. Rube had the look of a hitter. He seemed to be holding himself back from walking right into the ball. And he hit one high and far away. The fast Carl could not get under it, though he made a valiant effort. Spears scored, and Rube's long strides carried him to third. The cold crowd in the stands came to life. Even the sore bleachers opened up. McCall dumped a slow teaser down the line, a hit that would easily have scored Rube, but he ran a little way, then stopped, tried to get back, and was easily touched out. Ashwell's hard chance gave the Bison's shortstop an error, and Stringer came up with two men on bases. Stringer hit a foul over the right field fence, and the crowd howled. Then he hit a hard, long drive into the center field's hands. Con? I don't know what to think, but dang me if we ain't hitting the ball, said Spears. Then to his players, a little more of that and we're back in our old shape. All in a minute. At 'em now. Rube, you dinged old pogey, pitch! Rube toed the rubber, wrapped his long brown fingers around the ball, stepped out as he swung, and zing! That inning, he unloosed a few more kinks in his arm, and he tried some new balls upon the Bisons. But whatever he used and wherever he put them, the result was the same. They cut the plate, and the Bisons were powerless. That inning marked the change in my team. They had come back. The hoodoo had vanished. The championship Worcester team was itself again. The Bisons were fighting, too, but Rube had them helpless. When they did hit a ball, one of my infielders snapped it up. No chances went to the outfield. I sat there listening to my man and reveled in a moment that I had long prayed for. Now you're pitching some, Rube. Another strike. Get him aboard, called Ashwell. Ding him, Rube. Dang him, called Captain Spears. Speed? Oh, no, yelled Bogart at third. It's all off, Rube. It's all off. All off. So, with the wonderful pitching of an angry Rube, the Worcester team came into its own again. I sat through it all without another word, without giving a signal. In a way, I realized the awakening of the bleachers and heard the pound of feet and the crash. But it was the spirit of my team that thrilled me. Next to that, the work of my new find absorbed me. I gloated over his easy, deceiving swing. I rose out of my seat when he threw that straight fastball, swift as a bullet, true as a plumb line. And when those hard-hitting, sure-bunting Bisons chopped in vain at the wonderful drop, I choked back a wild yell. For Rube meant the world to me that day. In the eighth, the score was 8-6. The Bisons had one scratch hit to their credit, but not a runner had got beyond first base. Again, Rube held them safely. One man strikeout, another fouling, and the third going out on a little fly. Crash, 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 crash! The bleachers were making up for many games in which they could not express their riotous feelings. It's a cinch we'll win, yelled a fan with a voice. Rube was the first man up in our half of the ninth, and his big bat lammed the first ball safe over second base. The crowd, hungry for victory, got to their feet and stayed upon their feet, calling, cheering for runs. It was the moment for me to get in the game, and I leaped up, strung like a wire and white-hot with inspiration. I sent Spears to the coaching box with orders to make Rube run on the first ball. I gripped McCall with hands that made him wince. Then I dropped back on the bench, spent and panting. It was only a game. Yet it meant so much. Little McCall was dark as a thundercloud, and his fiery eyes snapped. He was the fastest man in the league and could have bunted an arrow from a bow. The foxy bison third baseman edged in. Mac feinted to bunt toward him, then turned his bat inward and dumped a teasing curveball down the first base line. Rube ran as if in seven-league boots. Mac's short legs twinkled. He went like the wind. He leaped into first base with his long side and beat the throw. The stands and the bleachers seemed to be tumbling down. For a moment, the air was full of deafening sound. Then came the pause, the dying away of clatter and roar, the close waiting, suspended, quiet. Spears' clear voice, as he coached Rube in its keen note, seemed inevitable of another run. Ashwell took his stand. He was another left-hand hitter, and against a right-hand pitcher in such circumstances as these, the most dangerous of men. Vane knew it. Ellis, the bison captain, knew it too, as showed plainly in his signal to catch Rube at second. But Spears' warning held or frightened Rube on the bag. Vane wasted a ball, then another. Ashwell could not be coaxed. Wearily, Vane swung. The shortstop raced out to get in line for a possible hit through the wide space to his right, and the second baseman got on his toes as both base runners started. Crack! The old story of the hit-and-run game. Ashwell's hit crossed sharply where a moment before the shortstop had been standing. With giant strides, Rube rounded the corner and scored. McCall flitted through second, and diving into third with a cloud of dust, got the umpire's decision. When Stringer hurried up, with Mac on third and Ash on first, the whole field seemed racked in a deafening storm. Again, it subsided quickly. The hopes of the Worcester fans had been crushed too often of late for them to be fearless. But I had no fear. I only wanted the suspense to end. I was like a man clamped in a vise. Stringer stood motionless. Mac bent low with the sprinter's stoop. Ash watched the pitcher's arm and slowly edged off first. Stringer waited for one strike and two balls. Then he hit the next. It hugged the first base line, bounced fiercely past the bag, and skipped over the grass to bump hard into the fence. McCall romped home, and lame Ashwell beat any run he had ever made to the plate. Rolling, swelling, crashing roar of frenzied feet could not down the high-piercing, sustained yell of the fans. It was great! 3 weeks of submerged, bottled baseball joy exploded in one mad burst. The fans, too, had come into their own again. We scored no more, but the Bisons were beat. Their spirit was broken. This did not make the Rube let up in their last half inning. Grim and pale, he faced them. At every long step and swing, he tossed his shock of light hair. At the end, he was even stronger than at the beginning. He still had the glancing, floating, airy quality that baseball players call speed. And he struck out the last three batters. In the tumult that burst over my ears, I sat staring at the dots on my scorecard. 14 strikeouts, one scratch hit, no base on balls since the first inning. That told the story which deadened senses doubted. There was a roar in my ears. Someone was pounding me. As I struggled to get into the dressing room, the crowd mobbed me. But I did not hear what they yelled. I had a kind of misty veil before my eyes, in which I saw that lanky Rube magnified into a glorious figure. I saw the pennant waving, and the gleam of a white cottage through the trees, and a trim figure waiting at the gate. Then I rolled into the dressing room. Somehow it seemed strange to me. Most of the players were stretched out in peculiar convulsions. Old Spears sat with drooping head. Then a wild, flaming-eyed giant swooped upon me. With a voice of thunder, he announced, "I'm gonna lick you too!" And after that, we never called him any name except Rube.
Ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team.
Shoeless Joe Jackson Comes to Iowa by W.P. Kinsella. My father said he saw him years later playing in the 10th-rate commercial league in a textile town in California, wearing shoes and an assumed name. He'd put on 50 pounds and the spring was gone from his step in the outfield, but he could still hit. Oh, how that man could hit. No one has ever been able to hit like Shoeless Joe. 3 years ago at dusk on a spring evening when the sky was a robin's egg blue and the wind was as soft as a day-old chick, I was sitting on the veranda of my farm home in eastern Iowa when a voice very clearly said to me, "If you build it, he will come." I instantly envisioned the finished product I knew I was being asked to conceive. I could see the dark, squarish speakers, like ancient sailors' hats, attached to the aluminum-painted light standards that glowed down into the baseball field, my present position being directly behind home plate. In reality, all anyone else could see out there in front of me was a tattered lawn of mostly dandelions and quack grass that petered out at the edge of a cornfield, perhaps 50 yards from the house. Anyone else was my wife Annie, my daughter Karen, a colored collie named Camelita Pope, and a cinnamon and white guinea pig named Junior, who ate spaghetti and sang each time the fridge door opened. Karen and the dog were not quite 2 years old. A 3-hour lecture or a 500-page guidebook could not have given me clearer directions. Dimensions of ballparks jumped over and around me like fleas. Cost figures for light standards, floodlights, whirled around my head like the moss that dusted against the porch light above me. That was all the instruction I ever received. 2 announcements and a vision of a baseball field. I sat on the veranda until the satiny dark was complete. A few curdly clouds striped the moon, and it became so silent I could hear my eyes blink. Now I stand ready to cut into the cornfield, to chisel away a piece of our livelihood, to use as dream currency. And Annie says, "Oh, love, if it makes you happy, you should do it." She never once called me crazy. I carry her words in the back of my mind, stored away, the way a maiden aunt might wrap a brooch, a remembrance of a long-lost love. I understand how hard that was for her to say, and how it got harder as the project advanced, how she must have told her family not to ask me about the baseball field I was building, because they stared at me dumb-eyed, a row of silent, thick-set peasants with red faces. Not an imagination among them, except to forecast the wrath of God that will fall on the head of pagans such as I. If you build it, he will come. He, of course, was Shoeless Joe Jackson. Joseph Jefferson Shoeless Joe Jackson. In April of 1945, Ty Cobb picked Shoeless Joe as the best left fielder of all time. A famous sports writer once called Joe's glove the place where triples go to die. He never learned to read or write. He created legends with a bat and glove. Was it really a voice I heard? Or was it perhaps something inside me making a statement that I did not hear with ears but with my heart? Why should I want to follow this command? But as I ask, I already know the answer. I count the loves of my life. Annie, Karen, Iowa, baseball. The great God baseball. My birthstone is a diamond. When asked, I say my astrological sign is hit and run, which draws a lot of blank stares here in Iowa, where 50,000 people go to see the University of Iowa Hawkeyes football team, while 500 regulars, including me, watch the baseball team perform. My father, I've been told, talked baseball statistics to my mother's belly while waiting for me to be born.
My father. Born Glenn Ulin, North Dakota, April 14, 1890. Another diamond birthstone. Never saw a professional baseball game until 1919, when he came back from World War I, where he had been gassed at Passchendaele. He settled in Chicago, inhabited a room above a bar across from Comiskey Park, and quickly learned to live and die with the White Sox. Died a little when, as prohibitive favorites, they lost the 1919 World Series to Cincinnati. Died a lot the next summer when 8 members of the team were accused of throwing that World Series. Before I knew what baseball was, I knew of Connie Mack, John McGraw, Grover Cleveland Alexander, Ty Cobb, Babe Ruth, T. Speaker, Tinker to Evers to Chance, and of course, Shoeless Joe Jackson. My father loved the underdogs, cheered for the Brooklyn Dodgers and the hapless St. Louis Browns, loathed the Yankees, an inherited trait, I believe, and insisted that Shoeless Joe was innocent, a victim of big business and crooked gamblers. That first night, immediately after the voice and vision, I did nothing except sip my lemonade a little faster and rattle the ice cubes in my glass. The vision of the ballpark lingered, swimming, swaying, seeming to be made of red steam, though perhaps it was only the sunset. And there was a vision within the vision, one of Shoeless Joe Jackson playing left field. Shoeless Joe Jackson, who last played Major League Baseball in 1920, and was suspended for life, along with 7 of his compatriots, by Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis for his part in throwing the 1919 World Series. Instead of nursery rhymes, I was raised on the story of the Black Sox scandal, and instead of Tom Thumb or Rumpelstiltskin, I grew up hearing of the 8 disgraced ballplayers: Weaver, Seacott, Risberg, Felsch, Gandel, Williams, McMullen, and always Shoeless Joe Jackson. He hit .375 against the Reds in 1919 World Series and played errorless ball. 12 hits in an 8-game series, and they suspended him. Shoeless Joe became the symbol of tyranny of power over the powerless, and Kennesaw Mountain Landis became synonymous with the devil. Building a baseball field is more work than you might imagine. I laid out a whole field, but it was there in spirit only. It was really only left field that concerned me. Home plate was made from pieces of cracked 2x4 embedded in the earth. The pitcher's rubber rocked like a cradle when I stood on it. The bases were tray blocks of wood, unanchored. There was no backstop or grandstand, only 1 shaky bleacher beyond the left field grass. My intuition told me it was the grass that was important. It took me 3 seasons to hone that grass to its proper texture, to its proper color. 3 seasons I've spent seeding, watering, fussing, praying, coddling that field like a sick child. Now it glowed parrot green, cool as mint, soft as moss, lying there like a cashmere blanket. I've begun watching it in the evening, sitting on the rickety bleacher just beyond the fence, a bleacher I constructed for an audience of 1. My father played some baseball, Class B ball teams in Florida and California. I found his statistics in a dusty minor league record book. In Florida, he played for a team called the Angels, and according to his records, was a better-than-average catcher. He claimed to have visited all 48 states and every major league ballpark before at 40 he married and settled down in Montana, 2-day drive from the nearest major league. I tried to play, but ground balls bounced off my chest and fly balls dropped between my hands. Might have been a fair designated hitter, but the rule was too late in coming. There is the story of the urchin who tugged at Shoeless Joe Jackson's sleeve as he emerged from a Chicago courthouse, said, "Say it ain't so, Joe." Jackson's reply reported was, "I'm afraid it is, kid." When he comes, I won't put him on the spot by asking. The less said, the better. It is likely that he did accept money from gamblers, but throw the series? Never! Shoeless Joe Jackson led both teams in hitting that 1919 series. It was the circumstances. The players were paid peasant salaries while the owners became rich. The infamous 10-day clause, which voided contracts, could end any player's career without compensation, pension, or even a ticket home. And how did he get a name like Shoeless Joe? I would ask my father, knowing the story full well but wanting to hear it again. It wasn't the least bit romantic. When he was still in the minor leagues, he bought a new pair of spikes, and they hurt his feet. About the sixth inning, he took them off and played the outfield in just his socks. The other players kidded him, called him Shoeless Joe, and the name stuck for all time. It was hard for me to imagine that a sore-footed young outfielder taken off his shoes one afternoon, not long after the turn of the century, could generate a legend. One night, I watched Annie looking out the window. She's soft as a butterfly, Annie is. There's someone on your lawn. I can't see him clearly, but I can tell someone is there. She was quite right, at least about it being my lawn, although it is not in the strictest sense of the word a lawn. It is a left field. I had been more restless than usual that night. I have sensed the magic drawing closer, hovering somewhere out in the night like a zeppelin, silky and silent, floating like a moon until the time is right. It's Shoeless Joe Jackson. My heart sounds like someone flicking a balloon with his index finger. I step out onto the veranda. A ground mist like wisps of gauze snakes in slow circular motions just above the grass. On the porch wall, I find the switch, and the single battery of floodlights I have erected behind the left field fence sputters to life. Moonlight butters the Iowa night. Clover and corn smells are as thick as syrup. I experience a tingling like the tiniest of electric wires touching the back of my neck, sending warm sensations through me. Then, as the lights flare, a scar against the blue-black sky, I see Shoeless Joe Jackson standing out in left field. His feet spread wide, body bent forward from the waist, hands on hips. He waits. I hear the sharp crack of the bat, and Shoeless Joe drifts effortlessly a few steps to his left, raises his right hand to signal for the ball, camps under it, if only for a second or two, catches it, at the same time transferring it to his throwing hand, and fires it to the infield. I make my way to the left field, walking in darkness, far outside the third base line, behind where the third base stands would be. I climb up on the wobbly bleachers behind the fence. I can look right down on Shoeless Joe. He fields a single on one hop and pegs the ball to third. How does it play? The ball bounces true. I know. I'm smiling with pride, and my heart thumps mildly against my ribs. I've hit 1,000 line drives and as many grounders. It's true as a felt-top table. It is. It is true. I lean back and watch the game. From where I sit, the scene is as complete as in any of the Major League Baseball parks I have ever visited. The two teams, the stands, the fans, the lights, the vendors, the scoreboard. The only difference is that I sit alone in the left field bleacher, and the only player who seems to have any substance is Shoeless Joe Jackson. When Joe's team is at bat, the left fielder below is transparent, as if he were made of vapor. He performs mechanically, but seems not to have facial features. We do not converse. A great amphitheater of grandstand looms dark against the sky, and I cannot keep the promise I made myself not to ask Shoeless Joe Jackson about his suspension and what it means to him. While the pitcher warms up for the third inning, we talk. It must have been like having a part of me amputated, slick and smooth and painless. I'm told that old men wake in the night and scratch itchy legs that have been dust for 50 years. That was me. Years and years later, I'd wake up in the night with the smell of the ballpark in my nose and the cool of the grass on my feet. The thrill of the grass. How I wish my father could be here with me. If he'd lasted just a few months longer, he could have watched our grainy black and white TV as Bill Mazeroski homered in the bottom of the ninth to beat the Yankees 10-9. We would have joined hands and danced around the kitchen like madmen. The Yankees lose so seldom, you have to celebrate every single time. We were always going to go to a major league ball game, he and I. But the time was never right. The money always needed for something else. One of the last days of his life, late in the night, while I sat with him because the pain wouldn't let him sleep, the radio picked up a staticky station broadcasting the White Sox game. We hunched over the radio and cheered them on, but they lost. Dad told the story of the Black Sox scandal for the last time, told of seeing two of those World Series games, told of the way Shoeless Joe Jackson hit, told the dimensions of Comiskey Park, and how during the series, the mobsters in striped suits sat in the box seats with their colorful women, watching the game and perhaps making plans to go out later and kill a rival. You must go. I've been in all the major league parks. I want you to do it, too. The summers belong to somebody else now. Have for a long time. Oh, hell. You know what I mean. I did indeed. I loved the game. I'd have played for food money. I'd have played for free and worked for food. It was the game, the parks. The smell, the sound. Have you ever held a bat or a ball to your face? The varnish, the leather. And it was the crowd, the excitement of them rising as one when the ball was hit deep. The sound was like a chorus. Then there was the chug-a-lug of the tin Lizzies in the parking lot and the hotels with their brass spittoons in the lobbies and brass beds in the rooms. Makes me tingle all over like a kid on his way to his first doubleheader. Just talk about it. What happened to the sun? Only stadium in the big leagues that doesn't have them is Wrigley Field. The owners found that more people could attend night games. They even play the World Series at night now. It's hard to see the ball, especially at the plate. I wanted to ask about that day in December 1951. If he'd lived another few years, things might have been different. There was a move afoot to have his record cleared. But it died with him. I wanted to ask, but my instinct told me not to. There are things it is better not to know. It is one of those nights when the sky is close enough to touch, so close that looking up is like seeing my own eyes reflected in a rain barrel. I sit in the bleacher just outside the left field fence. I clutch in my hand a hot dog with mustard, onions, and green relish. Below me in left field, Shoeless Joe Jackson glides over the plush velvet grass, silent as a jungle cat. He prowls and paces, crouches, ready to spring. Nearly 300 feet away, the ball is pitched. At the sound of the bat, he wafts in whatever direction is required, as if he were on ball bearings. The crack of the bat is sharp as a yelp of a kicked cur. Shoeless Joe whirls, takes 5 loping strides directly toward me, turns again, reaches up, and the ball smacks into the glove. The final batter dawdles in the on-deck circle. Can I come back again? I built this for you. It's yours anytime you want to use it. They play 162 games a season now. There are others. If you were to finish the infield, why, old Chick Gandel could play the first base. And we'd have the Swede at shortstop and Buck Weaver at third. We could stick McMullen in at second. And Eddie Seacott and Lefty Williams would like to pitch again. Do you think he could finish center field? It would mean a lot to Happy Felch. Consider it done. Consider it done. An idea popped into my brain like a runner inching off first base. I know a catcher. He never made the majors, but in his prime he was good, really good. Played Class B ball in Florida and California. We could give him a try. You give us a place to play and we'll look at your catcher. I swear the stars have moved close enough to eavesdrop as I sit in the single rickety bleacher that I built with my unskilled hands, looking down at shoeless Joe Jackson. A breath of clover travels on the summer wind. Behind, just yards away, brook water splashes softly in the darkness. A frog shrills. Fireflies dazzle the night like red pepper. God, what an outfield. What a left field. This must be heaven. No, it's Iowa. But then I feel the night rubbing soft against my face like a cherry blossom. Think of the sleeping child in the house. Think of the fierce warmth of the woman waiting for me in there. Inhale the fresh-cut grass smell that seems locked in the air like a permanent incense. And listen to the drone of the crowd as below me, shoeless Joe Jackson tenses, watching the angle of the distant bat for a clue as to where the ball will be hit. I think you're right, Joe, I say softly enough, not to disturb his concentration. And that's our show for today. Thanks for joining me. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Jennifer March, and this is Not Your Mother's Storytime.